Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back. Today I thought I would dip my toes into something slightly different. A request that actually came from one of you guys in the comments, and I'm really sorry that I can't remember who actually gave me this idea, but thank you if you're watching this. I think this video is going to be really interesting. We're going to be taking a look at some deathbed confessions that may well have solved some enduring mysteries. Deathbed confessions are something which we'll often see in TV and movies. It's a very popular trope, a great cliffhanger moment, but this does occasionally happen in real life as well. And I don't think I really need to explain the psychology behind this. In their dying moments, people know there can no longer be repercussions for their past actions, and therefore they share their deepest secrets. Sometimes it's a crime that they committed themselves, perhaps leading to someone else's death, or sometimes it's a crime they know someone else committed. Depending on where you are in the world, deathbed confessions can actually be used in convictions or in criminal trials under the right circumstances. These circumstances being that essentially the confession makes sense and can be proven to an extent. You'll hopefully see what I mean as we go through this video. But let's begin easy with a non-true crimey deathbed confession, just a hoax. Yep, we're gonna begin with the Loch Ness Monster. You probably think of the legend of the Loch Ness Monster as being centuries old, but that's not quite the case. Although a local legend in the Scottish Highlands, if you said to a random person in London 100 years ago about something called the Loch Ness Monster, they likely wouldn't have had a clue what you were talking about. The modern mystery of Loch Ness began only 88 years ago in 1933, when a new road was built along the northern shore of the loch, allowing people to have access that they never really had before. One day, a couple spotted what they described as an enormous monster in the loch, something which a local Inverness courier wrote about in the paper. And from there, the story began to be told over and over again. In December 1933, the Daily Mail decided to go and investigate for themselves, hiring a famous game hunter called Marmaduke Wetherall to see if he could find the monster. He didn't, but he did report finding its tracks, which were apparently huge. Upon further investigation though, the National History Museum found that the tracks had actually been made with a fried hippo's foot, which were commonly used as umbrella stands at the time. Embarrassing for all, Wetherall and the Daily Mail. Which is why when in April 1934, a man came forward to the newspaper with this photograph that you may well recognise. If you're listening to this via my podcast, this is a black and white photo of water with a long neck and head of what seems to be some sort of creature poking out over the surface. For decades, this photo is referred to as the surgeon's photo, after the man who took the photo refused to have his name associated with it. Although it did later transpire that the man who snapped it was called Colonel Robert Wilson, a highly respected British surgeon who said that he'd stopped his car on the road running along the banks of Loch Ness to take the photo. This photo became the centre of a lot of discussion. Could it really be that such a creature lived in the depths of the loch? For decades, a lot of people did truly believe in the photo. If it was taken today, then understandably, people would probably be a lot more sceptical because we have Photoshop and any number of editing softwares. Pretty much anyone could fake a photo like this. But back in 1934, photo manipulation was a lot harder. Not impossible, but hard, and you wouldn't look at a photo and assume it had been faked. It wasn't until 1984 that the first rigorous study of this image took place, by Stuart Campbell for the British Journal of Photography. He decided that this photo was indeed real, but it wasn't of the Loch Ness Monster. He said it was an otter or marine bird or something around the same size as that. Turns out he was along the right tracks, but he was still wrong. But then, in 1994, a 90-year-old man called Christian Sperling died. Shortly before his death, Christian confessed to his involvement in a plot to create the famous surgeon's photo. Sperling's stepfather was none other than Marmaduke Wetherill, who was apparently a lot more embarrassed than people realise after the whole hippo's foot incident. He wanted vindication, he wanted to prove that the Loch Ness Monster was real so people would stop laughing at him. Christian Sperling said that back in 1934 he was approached by his stepfather to make a convincing model of a serpent-like creature, which he did, taking a Woolworths toy submarine and attaching a sculpted wooden head. The model was then taken to Loch Ness and was photographed by Wetherill. Only, of course, Wetherill couldn't then send the photo to the Daily Mail himself. It would look suspicious, and he wanted to get his revenge on the paper. Christian recalls him saying, "We'll give them their monster." So instead, he employs the help of a friend to bring it to the paper's attention, Colonel Wilson. It makes sense now why he refused to have his name associated with the photo. Here you can see the original version of the photograph, in which you can see just how small this model really was in comparison with the lake. The image given to the paper was cropped significantly, giving the illusion of this creature being so much larger than it was. Again, for my podcast viewers, this is just a zoomed out photo of what I described earlier. The model was actually really small. Still to this day, I think a lot of people use this photo as proof that the Loch Ness Monster is real. And if it wasn't for Sperling's deathbed confession, it may have continued that way for centuries more. Imagine carrying around a secret like that for decades, hearing people talk about the Loch Ness Monster, knowing that you're one of the main reasons why they probably know the myth in the first place. Who would have thought that a single photograph would have such a long-lasting effect on society? But you know what? I do hope it did embarrass the Daily Mail. For our next deathbed confession, I want to talk about a woman called Margaret Gibson, an American stage and silent film era actress. Throughout her career, she went by a number of different names, but mostly you'll find her credited as Margaret Gibson or Patricia Palmer. Throughout her career, she appeared in at least 130 different films, the vast majority of those being in the 1910s and just a few into the 1920s. Margaret had encounters with the law on a couple of occasions in her life. In 1917, she was arrested for vagrancy charges after allegations of drug dealing. She was ultimately acquitted for this, but it was after this point that she started to be credited as Patricia for her films, as the name Margaret Gibson was now tainted. But then in 1923, she was arrested once again on federal felony charges involving an alleged nationwide blackmail and extortion ring. After this point, her career really takes a nosedive. The rest of her life, though, she lived out relatively quietly. She moved to Singapore where she got married, but he ended up dying in the early days of World War II, so she moved back to Hollywood. It's reported that she lived on a widow's pension and rarely left the house for any reason, seen only by close neighbours. She was just this reclusive old lady who now took on the name Pat Lewis. On October 21st, 1964, aged 70 years old, Pat Lewis suffered a heart attack at home. An ambulance was called by a neighbour, but it would take 45 minutes to arrive. Margaret, or Pat, knew she was dying. It was in this moment that she, apparently a recently converted Roman Catholic, knew she needed to confess to her sins. She asked for a priest, but obviously one couldn't just be magicked up, so instead she confesses her sins to her neighbours. She explains her past life as a silent film actress before stating that she'd shot and killed a man called William Desmond Taylor. She said that at one point the authorities had almost caught her, and so she had to flee the country,
which is presumably when she went to live in Singapore. The neighbours with her at the time simply thought she was a delusional old woman. She certainly hadn't been an actress before or shot anyone, and they'd never heard of William Desmond Taylor. But they could never ask for any further clarification because Margaret died before she could reach the hospital. Her neighbours, a mother and son, were the beneficiaries of Pat slash Margaret's estate, and upon entering the house after her death, found a small case full of letters and theatrical stills of Margaret when she was younger. Perhaps she really had been a silent film actress. But the Motion Picture Academy had no records of anyone by the name of Pat Lewis, of course. Around this time, the neighbour, the mother, noted that she'd heard Pat mention the murder of a man once before, when a small piece about the unsolved death of William Desmond Taylor came on TV one night, and she became hysterical. William Desmond Taylor was a film director and actor, a popular figure in the world of silent films. He directed 59 silent films and acted in a further 27. His personal life wasn't the best, it seems. He was born as William Cunningham Dean Taylor in Ireland, but eventually moved to New York City, which is where him and his family lived for many years. He married a woman called Ethel and they had a daughter together, until one day in 1908, William suddenly disappeared, completely deserting his wife and daughter. He was known to have depression and he drank heavily, so people wondered if he was even still alive or if he had a bout of amnesia, which apparently did happen to him occasionally. For many years, there wasn't really any sign of William, until in 1912 he arrived in California with a new name, William Desmond Taylor. With his social connections, he made a name for himself and started acting before eventually turning to directing. He directed some of the more popular films of the era, and then he eventually joined the army and even returned back to New York to visit his abandoned wife and daughter. But then everything ended when he was 49 years old on the 2nd of February 1922, when early in the morning his body was found inside his home at the Alvarado Court Apartments in Westlake, Los Angeles. Once word of his body got out, a crowd formed, and apparently a random doctor at the scene declared him dead of a stomach hemorrhage with very little examination. It didn't take long though until forensic investigators realised that it wasn't a stomach hemorrhage at all. He'd been shot once in the back. The gun was not found at the scene, confirming this to be a homicide. They found money and valuables on his body and in his home, suggesting that the motivation for this was not robbery. And it was thought that he died the night before on the evening of 1st of February 1922. Now this all happened at a time when film studios were king and William was employed with Paramount Studios. Having a contract with the studio in this time came with a number of conditions, morality clauses, strict instructions on how you were to publicly live your life. Your actions reflected directly on the studios and therefore on the studio's success. Paramount at this time had a couple of ongoing dramas, including the ongoing rape and murder trial of a comedian called Roscoe Arbuckle, and the well-documented drug addictions of a couple of actors, and the mysterious death by poison of one of these actors' wives. Yeah, just a bit of drama. All across the country, the more conservative people were up in arms about all of this, so it was in Paramount's best interest to ensure that the murder of William Desmond Taylor went as under the radar as possible. As soon as studio representatives heard about what happened, they turned up at the murder scene and fixed it as best they could. They took all the letters they could find, all the bootleg alcohol, even cleaned up the blood. By the time the police turned up, the scene was so compromised that they didn't have any chance of a good investigation. But that's not to say they didn't come up with some suspects though, including Mabel Normand, an actress and the last person to have seen William before his death. And there was also Mary Miles Minter, who had written him letters professing her undying love. And they were just the letters that the studio thought were okay enough to be left at the scene. William wasn't all too interested in Mary at all, considering that he was old enough to be her father, so perhaps she took this news badly and killed her. Now I'm saying the story out loud, I feel like I'm gonna have to make a full video on this case at some point. This is a true unsolved mystery with so many suspects. But right now, we're talking about the deathbed confession of Margaret Gibson. The link between Margaret and William at the time of his death is fairly loose. They did indeed work together before World War I in both theatre and films. They featured in a 1914 picture called The Kiss, and they would have been at the same studio in the early 20s. Their paths definitely would have crossed. But they weren't really linked together, they weren't known to have a particularly close relationship, or were there any rumours flying around about them not liking each other or being romantic, or at least any rumours that have stood the test of time anyway. Nobody ever made any connection between William and Margaret until her deathbed confession that she murdered him. But if this wasn't true, why on earth would she confess to such a thing? Was she trying to cover up someone else? Her name was literally never mentioned in association with his death. In hindsight, some people do make links between the murder of William and the rape and murder trial of Roscoe Arbuckle, the comedian, suggesting some sort of blackmail. Margaret was arrested a year after William's death for blackmail and extortion, after all. This link is limited though, because all of the police files in this case disappeared decades ago. I mean, by 1940 they were gone. And we still don't know if there's any basis in the deathbed confession. We don't know if Margaret had anything to do with it, and if she did kill him, we don't know why. For a lot of people, deathbed confessions have an intrinsic link with serial killers. A lot of serial killers confess to their final crimes on their deathbed, perhaps as part of their game, or perhaps so they don't face any further charges. Otis Tull was an American drifter and serial killer whose crime spans 1961 to 1983. He has 6 confirmed victims, but is claimed to have hundreds more, alongside his companion Henry Lee Lucas. In 1983, Tull confessed to the 81 murder of a 6-year-old boy called Adam Walsh, the son of John Walsh, who after his son's death found a passion for victim advocacy and went on to host America's Most Wanted. After disappearing from a Hollywood mall in July 1981, Adam's body was never found, but his head was found in a canal 2 weeks later, confirming his fate. Otis Tull originally admitted to the murder whilst being interviewed for an unrelated murder of a 20-year-old woman called Catherine Martin, but later his attorney denied everything, saying the confession had been recanted. Regardless, police did begin to investigate into this, but somehow police managed to lose Tull's car and its bloodstained interior, meaning they no longer had any investigation. There was nothing more they could do. Over the years, Tull confessed to hundreds of murders, most of which we can assume could not actually be attributed to him. There was no reason to think that Adam's murder didn't fall under this category, that he was just saying he did it but didn't really. He was a killer who liked to have this notoriety. But this is a deathbed confessions video, I hear you say. Thanks to their own blunders, pretty much, there was nothing the police could do after this original confession. But then, in 1996, Otis Tull died in prison. John Walsh always believed that Tull was responsible for his son's murder, and after Tull's death, his niece came forward, saying her uncle had once again confessed, this time on his deathbed, to the murder and decapitation of Adam Walsh. On the back of this confession, in 2008, it was officially announced that Otis Tull was the perpetrator. Investigators said that he had long been the prime suspect in this case, ever since the first confession, and they did admit that he probably could have been charged before, but the final deathbed confession pushed this case over the edge. Tull was officially declared as the murderer, and Adam's case was closed. But the police haven't revealed if there was any new physical evidence which solved this crime, which confirmed it for them. They don't even have any DNA evidence from the original crime scene, so it couldn't really have been that that linked it. Investigators just say they carried out a new extensive review of the case and came to the conclusion that it had to have been Tall. This seems to be a case of investigators always knew who was responsible, but the final deathbed confession just solidified it for them, and they were finally able to close the case and bring a bit of peace to his family. Finally, I want to share the deathbed confession of a man called Christopher Smith. A couple of months ago, I shared the story of the victims of the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, who plays a pretty big role in this story. 27-year-old Joan Mary Harrison was murdered on the 23rd November 1975 in the centre of Preston in the UK. She was described by the Lancashire Post as bubbly, house-proud, a loving mother of two who worked as a machinist and a shop assistant before her life took a turn for the worst. In the years before her death, she'd fallen into a bad relationship, which led her to begin drinking heavily and experimenting with drugs. Eventually, she fell back on payments for a house and she lost custody of her two daughters, which only led her to spiral further. Joan was sadly kicked to death and sexually assaulted in an attack which was eerily similar to the MO of Peter Sutcliffe, who around this time was just beginning what would become a 5-year-long murder spree. Joan would even be found with bite marks on her breast, the teeth marks showing a clear gap in the upper front teeth. Sutcliffe had the same and even bit the breast of 16-year-old Jane McDonald, who was one of his later victims. Even Joan's boots had been taken off and placed on the top of the rear of her thigh, which is another Ripper calling card. It was no surprise when eventually the Detective Chief Superintendent said publicly of Joan's case, "What was once a distinct possibility that the Ripper killed her has now become a probability." A lot of this assumption was based on a number of letters allegedly sent by the Ripper to the police. Letters which the police just assumed were legitimate. They discovered that whoever was sending these letters to them was a B blood type, and whoever had killed Joan was a B secretor. Essentially, whoever had sexually assaulted and killed her secreted blood in his semen. The blood group of her killer was rare as well, just 6% of the population, and this matched the DNA on the letters. For a long time, based on all of the evidence they had, it was just assumed that Joan Harrison was an early Ripper victim. But then rumours started to surface that these letters were a hoax, never sent by the Ripper at all. Rumour which was later confirmed to be true, they were sent by a man in Sunderland with no connection whatsoever to the murders. And just like that, there was doubt over whether Joan was linked to the Ripper at all. And then Peter Sutcliffe was caught, and despite admitting to many of his crimes, he always denied having any involvement in the death of Joan Harrison. And while Sutcliffe did indeed also have a B blood type, he was a non-secretor. His blood was never found in his semen. So now there was question. For years there was argument over whether or not Joan was a Ripper victim. Some people remained sure that she was, that the teeth marks were too similar to not have been caused by the same person, but others couldn't be convinced due to the secretor evidence. But then in 2011 there was an unexpected twist, when Lancashire Police announced they'd solved the case thanks to advances in DNA. In 2008, a man called Christopher Smith from Leeds had died from terminal lung cancer, just 6 days after he was arrested for drink driving. Over the course of his life, Smith had had a number of criminal convictions, ranging from assault and theft to sex crimes. Upon this final arrest though, he had a DNA swab taken, something which had never happened before. And he probably knew at this point that he was about to be captured for another one of his crimes, now that the police had his DNA on record. His death 6 days after this arrest was purely coincidental, it seems. He was already on the brink of death and he knew this. But the day before he died, on the 29th of January 2008, he wrote a 3-page note in a notebook and placed it in a drawer, something he knew would be found after he passed. The note reads, "To whoever it concerns, I would like to put the record straight. I can't go on with the guilt. I've lived with it for over 20 years. I am truly sorry for all the pain I have caused anyone. Please believe me when I say I am sorry. I love my grandkids and my daughter. I cannot go back to prison anymore. Please God help my family who I worship. I've been out of trouble for over 20 years, so please God help me. I'm so sorry. God forgive me. I love you all forever." Now, this note doesn't name Smith's crimes, but he likely knew that investigators would be able to make the link with the DNA they now had on file. On the back of this note, investigators dove into finding out for which crime Smith was responsible, and months later the DNA evidence placed him at the scene of Joan's death. It's thought that the attack was random, that he didn't know Joan personally. Smith had recently been released from prison in the area and may have just come across her. Graham Gardner, the head of crime for Lancashire Constabulary, said in a press release, "Advancements in DNA interpretation over the years has finally allowed us to identify Smith as the man at the scene of Joan's murder. That fact, coupled with other evidence we've gathered over recent months, has been sufficient to convince the Crown Prosecution Service that Smith would have been charged with her murder had he been alive today." Gardner has also said that it is with some regret that Smith is not still alive to stand trial for his crime, and that he was an incredibly violent man, particularly towards women. If his confession letter is to be believed though, he managed to stay out of trouble for the last 20 years of his life for the most part. Perhaps even without this confession letter, police would have eventually made the connection between his DNA and Joan Harrison's murder, but the letter certainly sped the process up. Between the two, there is no doubt that he is guilty of this crime, and finally Joan's family can have peace that they know what happened to her. No justice, but hopefully peace. So there you go, 4 deathbed confessions. I know this is a little bit different for me, but I've been enjoying experimenting with other formats recently and have been getting a lot of good feedback, so please do let me know what you think of this kind of video or if you have any other suggestions. I'd love to know the craziest deathbed confession cases that you know of. It doesn't even necessarily have to be crime related, just anything interesting. Thank you so much for tuning in this week, and I will see you in the next one. Bye guys.